Welcome back to Shattering Myths. If you'd like to participate in this discussion, you can do so calling toll-free 877-300-7645. There is no negotiation with religious supremacism. Religious supremacism cannot be appeased. Religious supremacism, as is the case of Islam, which Allah says that Muslims and their religion are the best, that they are destined to conquer and control the world. They don't want a piece of the pie. They want to devour the entire pie. The world learned that the hard way with Adolf Hitler. So did the countless kingdoms that attempted to negotiate peace with the armies of the Mohammedan conquerors. If Israel had never existed, Hamas would still exist, just as all of the other branches of the Muslim Brotherhood. If Netanyahu, Sharon, Begin, and 1,000 other Israeli victims are villains, I should say, of the apologists of Islam had never been born, the followers of Muhammad would have gone on killing Jews as they had for 1,400 years. If the Star of David had never waved over Jerusalem, if Jews had remained as downtrodden and if they had remained persecuted in the lands of Islam, just as the Zoroastrians, just as the Copt, Assyrian, Byzantine, and Serbian Christians, they would have been murdered by the Muslims who were raised by their mothers to usher in the victory of Islam. There is no political solution to this conflict. There is no amount of concessions that can make religious hatred go away. If 1,400 years of Jewish humiliation and persecution have not yet satisfied Muslims, how will handing over part of Jerusalem do that job? They've conquered it before. Didn't stop them then. Solutions begin with the truth. The truth is that Islamic violence against Jews is not recent, nor is it exceptional. The murder of Jews by Muslims, whether in Israel or Belgium, is not any different than the Muslim butchery of Christians throughout the history of this menacing doctrine. Hindus, Buddhists, and even minority Muslim sects are prey for a religion conceived to impose itself on the world through war. These conflicts cannot be resolved through appeasement. They can only be addressed through repulsion. It is long past time that the world comes to speak with one clear voice against the most savage and uncivilized dogma ever perpetrated on humankind. It's long past time to say no to Islam. It is not the victims of a 1,400-year campaign against them who need to appease the belligerents. It's the belligerents who must come to terms with the horrors that they have inflicted through a campaign of thievery and terror, of conquest and ethnic cleansing. It's time for them to seek reconciliation with their victims. There can be no peace until everyone, including Muslims, understand that the Mohammedan conquests were a genocidal atrocity that destroyed entire civilizations and cultures. Only then can they honestly condemn ISIS, the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, for trying to repeat those atrocities. Only after rejecting their religion will they be able to live in peace with others in this world. That is our reality. That is the truth. So long as there's any discussion of occupied territories, if there is any discussion of a political solution, of negotiation, then we're on the wrong track. We're headed in the wrong direction. I want to share an article. I mentioned it in the first hour of the program, but I do want to share an article with you that I found horribly troubling. It appeared on almost every major news source. This version of it is from CNN. Complete shock, it begins. Surprise and disappointment. That was my reaction to revelations from documents released by Edward Snowden that the National Security Agency monitored my emails from 2006 to 2008 after I had left the Bush White House. This is written by Fazil Gill, a lawyer, a longtime Republican Party operative, who served in the Department of Homeland Security, a Muslim, under George W. Bush. Imagine, you create the Department of Homeland Security because 19 Muslims screaming Allahu Akbar were suicide bombers and flew planes into the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. And then in the Department of Homeland Security, in the White House, you empower a Muslim. And then when that Muslim reads that the NSA was monitoring his emails, he can't understand why. I mean, it's a world that has gone mad. Imagine a person that doesn't understand the connection between Islam and 9/11, working in the Department of Homeland Security, and not understanding why he is being monitored because he is a leading authority in the U.S. Capitol, and he's a Muslim. He went on to say, I am one of five professionals featured in an article in The Intercept who found the government was monitoring us without our knowledge. The others are Ghafoor, a well-known lawyer, Amr Hadi, a professor at Rutgers, Sayed, a political science professor at California State University, Awad, an executive director of the Council on American Islamic Relations. Let me tell you, every one of those people should be monitored. I think that the most counterproductive organization within America that isn't part of the U.S. government would be CARE, the Council on American Islamic Relations. Their goal is to disguise Islam's menace. Their goal is to keep universities from telling their students the truth about Islam. Their goal is to boycott and do economic harm to anyone that tells the truth about Islam. They know that Islam is a terrorist dogma. They know that it's a declaration of war against all humankind. They know that Muhammad was a terrorist. They know that Muhammad encouraged kidnap and rape. They know that Muhammad participated in the slave trade. They know that Islam is responsible for the kidnap and torture and rape of the girls in Nigeria. They know that Islam is responsible for the murder of 300,000 people in Syria and the rape of close to a million. They know that Islam is responsible for mutilating the genitals of 250 million little girls. They know all of this. They just don't want you to know it. When you lie on behalf of a religion, which is what every one of those individuals does, you make the victims of that religion more vulnerable. Not only ought these men have been monitored by the NSA, they ought to have been exiled from this country. You cannot be a good Muslim without being a traitor. You cannot be a good Muslim without being a terrorist. You cannot be a good Muslim without being a horrible person. He writes, what we share in common is we are all Muslim, and none of us can believe there is any reason we should fall under suspicion. Then you are an idiot, pal. A complete buffoon. If you do not know Islam well enough to understand that Islamic terrorists represent 99% of terrorism around the world, that everything that the NSA, even if you look at it, the brightest possible interpretation, and Homeland Security have attempted to do is to prohibit Muslims from terrorizing more Americans. And you wonder why, as a Muslim, you would be under surveillance? Are you that ignorant of Islam? A complete nincompoop that you define yourself as a Muslim and you've got no clue what the Islamic scriptures actually say. You've never read the Quran. You've never read the Hadith. You don't know that Islam is a declaration of war against all humankind. You don't know that Muhammad was a terrorist. You don't know that Sharia law not only endorses terrorism but requires it. Or are you just completely disingenuous that you know the truth, you are a traitor, and you're acting to undermine the United States by making it more vulnerable, by making people feel guilty that as a Muslim you were being followed? The only hope to eradicate terrorism from this world, the only hope to keep this world from engaging in World War III where billions are going to die, is to make the religion of Islam illegal and then to quarantine Muslims. That's it. There is no other hope. You'll either do that as a nation or the nation will die. Hundreds of millions in America, billions around the world. Don't say that as conjecture. I don't say that as my opinion. I don't say that even to scare you. I just want you to know the consequence. You will either make Islam illegal because you won't listen to idiots like this, that you'll come to read the Quran and Hadith. You'll come to know exactly what Muhammad created. You'll know that Allah was modeled after Satan. You'll know that Islam is a declaration of war against all humankind, that it cannot coexist in a civilized world, that it is incredibly sexist, depriving women of all rights, that it is absolutely vicious and merciless. You'll either come to know those things and outlaw it in America because it inspires people to commit crimes, and therefore it is illegal, and you quarantine Muslims to the Islamic majority nations, where they can do no one other than themselves harm. Or the fact is, billions of people are going to die. You tell me which one is more merciful. You tell me which one is more merciless. You tell me which is more reasonable and rational. Those are your choices. You can't resolve Islam. You can't reform Islam. You can't save a fundamentalist Muslim from Islam. You can't reason with them. You will either outlaw them and quarantine them, or they will destroy everything. Welcome back to Shattering Mess. We have Kirk on the phone. Kirk, it's an extraordinarily sad situation where you've got a group of people that that are hell-bent to eradicate an entire race, to obliterate a country, and yet the world looks at the Israeli-Muslim conflict as if these two belligerents are both to blame, and that they need to provide concessions, where Israel must give a people who don't even know who they belong to, a mythical people known as the Palestinians, their own country. What do you think will happen if Israel does that?
Well, they have no, they'll be surrounded. I mean, it's over. I mean, that's yes. You don't have to think further than, you have all these people hate you, and now you're down to the size of a nickel. Where are you going to go?
Yeah, and by the way, if you give them their own country, and according to the lines drawn at for UN 242, then would Israel have the ability to cordon off weapon supplies into this new mythical place called Palestine?
Absolutely not. How could they?
Yeah. And how wide would Israel be where 70% of the people live?
I think I read it was like 5 to 7 miles wide, maybe 15 at the tops, but nothing that you couldn't run across real quick.
Yeah, the narrowest place right above Tel Aviv, the nation of Israel would be 5 miles wide.
5 miles, that's
and surrounded on both sides with a religiously motivated people who for 1,400 years have been enraged with one thought in mind, killing Jews. And that's what the world wants Israel to do, and they think that's going to bring peace. How well did giving the high ground to Czechoslovakia do to appease Adolf Hitler?
Well, it didn't stop him. It just helped him. I mean, you just raise him more.
You know, what's interesting about Adolf Hitler, when you study the appeasement of Neville Chamberlain, of giving the high ground to Czechoslovakia, that the internal documentation that has subsequently been released from Nazi Germany at that time is that most of the high-ranking German military were planning to depose Hitler. They had no confidence in him. They thought he was a lunatic that would bring them great harm. And the most of the high-ranking German military leaders wanted to do away with. They wanted to lead a coup against Hitler until Hitler won the concession of Czechoslovakia from Neville Chamberlain. And when Hitler came back, he was so loved by the people for having fooled the English this way, having won this great concession of land, that the generals said, well, you know, we can't oppose them without the people lynching us, so we might as well go along. So it was literally the concession of Czechoslovakia that enabled World War II. So we played this game before.
Yes, we have. You know, it's people are always, it seems like, you know, in Europe, there was Napoleon. He tried to unify all of Europe by conquering and so forth. It's the same old dictator, but this is even worse because they don't have an end game. I mean, if they don't want to just conquer and take over, they want to kill everybody.
No.
I mean, that's the part.
And one of the things about Islam is that the Quran tells them to continue to fight and kill until everyone is humiliated. Everyone is in subjection to them. Everyone submits Islam to them. And there is no way to offer a concession to someone who actually believes that God wants them to lash out and kill everyone until only left with two groups of people: those who are Muslims and those who are surrendered to and are humiliated by Muslims.
And then who's going to do anything? How do you survive? Right. I mean, if you kill everybody that does all the work and you don't work, who feeds you?
Yeah. Well, let me give you an example here. What percentage today of Iraq is Muslim?
Well, just about 90-something%, if not. I don't know if it could be greater, but it can't be any less.
Yeah, it used to be about 95%, and there were about 5% of the country that was Christians. It's now 99% of Iraq that is Muslims. How are they getting along now that they have wiped out everyone other than Muslims in Iraq? Are they all getting along splendidly? Is it peaceful coexistence?
Just
turn on each other. And that, by the way, will be the consequence if Muslims ultimately prevail and destroying everyone else, they will then turn on themselves and kill themselves. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Misery. I'm in a conversation with Kirk. Kirk, it sounds like a horrible choice when you say you have to make a religion, Islam, illegal, and you have to quarantine Muslims, or else billions of people are going to die. But this is not a hypothetical. Islam has been trying to conquer the world for 1,400 years. And now, armed with American weapons, they are the world's greatest belligerents. But it's beyond just the obvious that as you look at history and you read what is happening today, particularly in Syria and Iraq, and also in Israel. But Yahweh was really clear in his prophecies, and he hasn't got a single prediction wrong, and he said that this war that's taking place in greater Syria, which would be Syria and Iraq, that this war is going to ultimately cause Israel to be thinned, and once Israel's thinned at the waist, that Muslims by the hundreds of millions are going to flood into Israel, and they're going to start World War III. So that is our choice.
You know, in your quarantine thing, can I just interject
something?
If the local church or a local group, church group, decided to have human sacrificing, how long would it take the authorities to shut that place down?
Oh, instantly.
Okay. What's the difference?
Nothing.
Between that and Muslims.
Really. What's the difference? That's what they're doing in Syria. That's what they're doing in Iraq. That's what they're trying to do in Israel. It's human sacrifice.
So if you saw somebody over there that was doing the human sacrifice thing as an example, would you say, well, it's okay if they come over here and bring all the garbage with them? I mean, you just wouldn't do that. I would hardly think that the plan of quarantine or to not support them in any way economically would be harmful. It'd be mostly helpful. If you don't want them, they can't kill each other as easily.
You have a religion that calls for human sacrifice. You have a religion that has perpetrated human sacrifice for 1,400 years. Do you think that it's a smart play to not only invite that religion into your home, to your country, but also to provide them with your most sophisticated weapons?
Hardly. Hardly.
But that's what we're doing.
Of course.
Do you think that it's a good idea to enrich them by paying egregious amounts of money for black ooze out of their sands?
Not if you have an alternative. I mean, if your economy runs on it, you got to make some concessions for a while, but you need to work on where can I get oil? And there's a lot of places you can get oil.
Yeah. And the simple truth is that you can get all we want. We can yell and scream all we want. But the bottom line is that either Islam is going to be made illegal in America and the world's going to quarantine Muslims, or billions of people are going to die as a result of Islam. Those are the choices, and you can pick your poison.
Well, I called to ask a couple of questions relating to prophecy, and they're kind of related. And I had a question in Yashayahu when the Yehudim called the gift is returned to Jerusalem during the tribulation. If those of us who accept or are part of the covenant family exist in the time as adopted Yehudims, would we be sent back to Jerusalem as well?
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting question. First of all, the recall from America, and it's very specific that it's America that Yahweh is rescuing his children from, and these are Yehudim, these are Israelites that he is rescuing from America, because during the waning years of the tribulation, the anti-Semitic rage against them will be so egregious that he has to rescue them to save them, just to have them be spared. Otherwise, even in America, America will be killed. And so he specifically says that he's going to rescue them, and specifically from America, where 42% of the world's Jewish population resides. 42% is Israel today, 42% in America, the rest, 16% are around the world. Now, what you're asking really is, what about those of us who are Goyim that were adopted into the covenant family? Prior to the second half of the tribulation, which is when this occurs, everyone, both naturally born, that's for a Israelite, and those of us who are adopted into the covenant's family, are going to be gleaned. We're going to be harvested. There'll be at that time 4,000 of us Goyim that will be harvested, and 3,000. Israelites will be harvested, so we will already be gone.
Now, that's not a complete answer
though,
okay.
Because once we're gone, there will be those, not many, but there will be those who are not Israelites, who are not Jewish, who are going to come to know Yahweh, are going to come to learn from His Torah, who are going to accept the terms and conditions of the covenant. And so then the question would be, would those, particularly in America, because this you're speaking of the 18th chapter of Yashayahu Isaiah, which is specifically addressing the United States of America, a warning to the United States. It says all really horrible things about the United States. All true, but horrible. The question is, would they be included in those who are rescued? And I think the answer is resounding yes.
So the return, though, that's going to be like in 2030 or later?
His return is in 2033. Yeah.
No, I'm talking about the people of being returned to Yehudim that are being returned.
Oh, yeah, yes. And the reason we know these times is that Yahweh laid out a very detailed pattern for us of time. And we know that less than a score, less than 6,000 years ago, is when Chawa and Adam were expelled from the Garden of Great Joy, the Garden of Eden. And that exactly 1,000 years after that, when the Merkel impact crater hit, is when the flood occurred in Mesopotamia, going up through the Black Sea. And 1,000 years after that, in 1968 BCE, that's when Abraham and Yitzhak affirmed the covenant with Yahweh on Mount Moriah. And 1,000 years exactly after that, in 968 BCE, is when David left all the materials and his son Solomon laid the cornerstone of the temple. And then 1,000 years after that, in 33 CE, is year 4000 Yah, is when Yahusha fulfilled the first four Mikra, enabling the promises of the covenant. And that was year 4,000 Yah. So to get to year 6,000 Yah, all you have to do is add 40 Yobel. Yobels are 50-year periods of time, 7 times 7 plus 1. And you get to 2033 on our pagan calendar, which is year 6,000 Yah. And that's when he's going to return. He's going to return to fulfill Yom Kippurim. So we know on our calendar, October 2nd, at sundown, in 2033 is when he's going to return. So you can subtract 7 years from that, and you get the beginning of the tribulation.
2026.
Now, yeah, the time of Jacob's trouble, to use the Hebrew term, although tribulation is how it's described in Hebrew as well. Now, the issue, though, Kirk, is that, and you know, I'm kind of just in this process now, trying to get a real firm grasp on this, but everything I read suggests that there really are two successive tribulations. There's a tribulation light and the tribulation heavy. And the tribulation light is the first 3.5 years. Now, I don't want to make any aspersions here that there are ideas that means it's going to be a jolly old good time. No, the first 3.5 years are going to be hell on earth. It's going to really be miserable.
Be anything else. Yeah.
But the last 3.5 years, Yahweh says, I'm out of here. I can't tolerate the sight of you. I don't like the smell of you. I don't like anything you have to say or do. And I have just gleaned my family. I'm going to enjoy my family. And he leaves the earth entirely to mankind and to Satan for 3.5 years. And that 3.5 year tribulation is the great tribulation, and it is hell on earth. And so that being the case, you have to look at when is God going to remove his people from Israel. And my sense is that he ends the Magog War before the midpoint of the tribulation, and he rescues his children from America at that time and brings them into to Israel. And then he is effectively out of here until he has to return to save the earth from being completely annihilated.
Okay. But you had mentioned before that there's no reason to believe that we wouldn't be here to the midpoint of the.
The reason I've said that. Now, you know, first, if you just look at the Greek text of Revelation, you would assume that we're going to be kept out of the tribulation. But is it the first 3.5 years or the second 3.5 years or all 7 years of the tribulation? And it has ek, that the Philadelphian ecclesia, those who love his word and his name, are kept out. But you've got to realize that's translated in Greek. We don't have you don't have many corroborating manuscripts, and it's been translated out of Hebrew into to Greek and been very poorly maintained. When you read the Hebrew, particularly the best maintained Hebrew, which would be Isaiah, the chronology clearly is that that the Syrian war becomes the pretext for World War III. What we've just been talking about, you either quarantine Islam or you're going to get World War III and billions are going to die.
Yes.
God's really clear. He says that the last battle for humankind and the path to the tribulation began in greater Syria, between Syria and Iraq, with Islamic terrorism. And that it then leads to the divestiture of the West Bank to the Muslims, which then encourage Muslims to flood into Israel in the Magog War. And then it's between Israel being thinned at the waist and the onslaught of Muslims to destroy Israel that the gleaning takes place. So, since Daniel seems to imply that the beginning of the lighter phase of the tribulation begins with that peace treaty where Israel is thinned at the waist.
Mm-hmm.
Since the harvest occurs thereafter, you know, we might be here a little while.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome back to Saturday Miss. We're in the midst of a conversation with Kirk at this point about the timing of major events that will occur in the next 15 to 20 years. And, Kirk, when I viewed this harvest that's associated with Teruah from the perspective of Revelation, you come to the conclusion that the Teruah harvest will occur right before the beginning of the tribulation, or certainly within months to years prior to the beginning of the tribulation, because it says you'll be kept out of the tribulation. What it does not say, though, and you have to think through, is that there really are two different tribulations, in the sense that God's really clear about what happens in the first 3.5 years and the second 3.5 years. But when you turn then to Isaiah and you have this chronology of events of the war that's currently being fought in Syria and Iraq, leading to the divestiture of Israel, leading to the harvest of the covenant family, leading to the Magog War, what you find is that while you would assume that the harvest of Yah's covenant children would then occur either at the same time, simultaneous with the treaty that Daniel seems to suggest ushers in the tribulation, or sometime soon thereafter. And the reason I say soon thereafter is I don't think we can get all the way to the end of the Magog War, because it's, you know, the order of things is the Syrian war with all these terrorists, and the terrorists finally having no one left to terrorize there and having to go elsewhere, the surrender of Israeli land, the gleaning, and then the commencement, not the conclusion, but the commencement of the Magog, all Islamic war against Israel, and then Yahweh himself intervenes to stop that war and to blow the Muslims away. And so you would, and that all occurs before the midpoint of the tribulation.
Well,
so the entire war has to take place, you know, after we're gone.
Well, that kind of was my second part of the question, was that, you know, according to Yah, and also confirmed by NASA now, the meteor of Apophis coming in April of 2029. So if you're here, we're pretty well wiped out here when that hits.
And April 13th, 2029 is really right in the midpoint of the tribulation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and what you're mentioning is Apophis or Apophis, depending on how you pronounce it, but it's in the Greek transliteration, it'd be Asphenthos, but again, Greek does a very poor job of transliterating Hebrew words. It's the Greek alphabet and the Hebrew alphabet do not mesh well.
Yeah.
And so the difference between Asphenthos and Apophis is probably nothing more than Greek doing a horrible job of transliterating.
Transliteration, yeah.
Yeah, transliteration. Now, so there's a lot more to Apophis than what we have previously talked about. I mean, we've known for a long time that Yahweh says that in the midpoint of the tribulation that an asteroid is going to strike the earth. He's very clear. He calls it an aster, which is the basis of asteroid, and he claims that it's going to strike the earth, and he even talks about the destruction that's specifically related to this asteroid strike. And you can actually date the timing of the strike based upon the chronology of events, and because God's really clear about how much time transpires in various things. And he said that an asteroid is going to strike, and if you put it, translated from his calendar to our calendar, it would be April 13th, which is a Friday, in 2029. And then in 2004, which was almost 2,000 years after that testimony was committed to writing, scientists discovered an asteroid, MN2004, that they named Apophis, that they said was going to come so close to the Earth on Friday, April 13th, 2029, that it would be inside of our satellite orbits. I mean, it's not only inside the moon's orbit, it's inside of our satellite orbits. And subsequently, scientists have said, oh, you know, we're not concerned because we have now done the math and it's going to miss us. Well, one of NASA's largest projects now is to put a probe on Apophis and then to follow it, because we're quite concerned that it will get nudged. We'll be back in a moment.